informal session with you at your control from now until noon. I'll be at the Fed luncheon served in the cafeteria at 12 o'clock. And we can usually chat with each other and exchange the ideas down there until 1:30. At 1:30, we'll be with Ray. At 1:30, we'll come back to this room. You can seminar, you can answer questions, ask questions, just have a good exchange with the graduate students. So I said, now we have the first year, second year, and we have Dr. Italian, who is soon to be first year, happens to be a Catholic California as well, and graduates with the faculty members this evening. Guest again to the Alumni Association. It's not a function of the school or the school budget or the faculty, but it's an Alumni Association day. And it's an honor of the graduating second year students. So we meet again, they go off the ship, open bar, come early, stay late. There should be a fun day. Well, this time I'd like to introduce our speaker. Started, and so many of us can trace our roots back lovingly to Dr. Grossman. His life has spanned so many years. We were talking last night. He took his advanced degree in the year that I was born. That is an advanced degree in Europe, having already graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and practiced for 5 years before he went for an advanced degree in the year that I was born. And he has an energy that equals mine in every respect, and probably exceeds it. From a very personal point of view, he is my inspiration and my first teacher in endodontics and anything that I know. I learned from him in the vision that I have. I have his lifted me to the point that I can see something ahead, but I stand elevated because of what he brought me to be. And under those circumstances, it's a very moving day for me, really, to be able to introduce to you the world I've lived.
Very difficult for me to know what to talk on because any subject in endodontics that I choose to talk on, I know that Dr. Schilder would be my equal or better because he still has the enthusiasm of youth and can get his ideas across extremely well. I therefore chose a subject on which he would not be able to talk on as well as I. And that is, I'm planning to talk to you on a bit of dental history. As a matter of fact, Dr. Schilder asked me this morning, what is the title of my talk? And I said, a bit of this and a bit of that. Actually, the major theme of my talk this morning will be on focal infection. And this afternoon on transplantation. I shouldn't say transplantation, but rather on replantation, transplantation, and also intentional replantation. Perhaps I ought to start at the very beginning. graduated from high school and went immediately to the dental school. I missed out a 3-year dental school course by only 2 years, and for which I felt sorry, because had I been born 2 years earlier, I would have completed my dental school course in 3 years instead of 4. You know, we older people talk of the good old days. Well, the good old days are now. Your good old days are now. Let me give you some insight of what a dental school course and experience was like in 1919 when I first entered the dental school. The X-ray machine, as we know it today, was only 2 years old. We still had an overhead rail from which was suspended a large tube which had been used for medical x-rays. Yes, we had two dental x-ray machines. I will show you a photograph of that machine and some of the early machines a little later on. We had a class of 253. Remember, this is soon after the First World War. And we had only 137 chairs in our clinic. You can well imagine what that meant. It meant that if we had a lecture and the clinic immediately afterward, the students would start slipping out about halfway through the lecture to get out in the clinic to hold a chair. We did not have electric motors, engines, as we know them today, let alone high speed. We had foot engines, which we had to carry from the locker room down the basement to the second floor and back again. A foot engine, as you probably know, is a treadle type engine which you operated by foot power to give motor power to the burr. Yes, we had the Novocaine or propane, but we did not use it for cavity preparation. The idea was to use a small burr at low speed to produce the minimum amount of pain. The use of anesthesia for cavity preparation did not really become common until the 1930s. We put in tin foil fillings as well as gold foil fillings. The idea was that if you could put a tin foil filling in, you could also put a gold foil filling in with greater ease. We use copper amalgam for certain teeth, especially deciduous teeth, and the copper amalgam came in the form of a little diamond or a little disc, which you heated in a spoon over an alcohol flame, because it already had the mercury in it. And when you saw the globules of mercury appearing on the surface of the diamond or disc, then you knew that you simply poured it out into a hand-operated mortar and pestle, and that is what you used for filling deciduous teeth and some permanent teeth. Indirect inlays were not known. At least not until my senior year. And I do not recall whether I made an indirect inlay, because I do recall having to work exceedingly hard to make a direct inlay, which meant carving the pattern right in the mouth. You can imagine how difficult that was under certain situations. Crowns were made from a shell, which was then hammered with a wooden or horn mallet over a die which had been carved to desired occlusion. Also, for anterior teeth, open face crowns were made. That is, an opening was cut in the crown to show the enamel. Occasionally, some of the black people in Philadelphia liked to show how affluent they were, and they would have a diamond put in a complete gold crown. One of my classmates, whose father was a dentist, practiced on South Street, and he was known for that. We had advertising dentists galore. On Market Street, for example, you couldn't walk by an advertising dentist's office, which was generally on the second floor of a store. Market Street is one of the main thoroughfares in the center of the city. There was a showcase showing models of various kinds of gold appliances, and then there was a liveried, I remember the one that I kind of liked, was dressed in a green attire and had a baton, and he would attract your attention by knocking on this glass plate. Impressions were taken always in plaster of Paris because we had no other material other than modeling compound. So that full dentures were often made by taking an impression first in modeling compound, I trust you know what that is, and then a plaster wash. The modeling compound was scratched to make the surface rough, and then a thin plaster wash was placed in the tray, and an impression taken for full dentures. For that was easy. For partial dentures, again, we used nothing more than plaster of Paris. The tray, the inside of the tray was oiled or Vaseline. Plaster was poured in. The tray was placed in the mouth, and when the plaster became hard, then the tray, having been oiled or greased beforehand, the tray was removed. Then you took a knife and you scored approximately in the center of the occlusal surfaces, in the center of the incisal surfaces, all around, and then you made another score on each in each canine area, and you broke it apart. Then you had a Chinese puzzle put together. And you were very fortunate that you had all the pieces. Some were rather tiny, and you spent perhaps half an hour putting it together, and that's how we took impressions in those days. Even before that, however, as part of the technique course, we had to swage gold plates. Now, swaging meant this. You took an impression, you made a model, and then you trimmed the model in a certain way, and you invested the model in lycopodium. I'm sure that's a word that you never heard of. And then you very, very carefully removed the model. The model had been coated with either shellac or sandrack to make it smooth. You remove the model very carefully and destroyed it. And then you heated a compound of lead and tin, or lead, tin, and bismuth, and until it was molten, and by means of a hole, you poured the molten metal. Now that made a dye of lead, tin, and bismuth, and then you made a counter dye in lead. So, you had a die and a counter die. The die was a reproduction of the plaster model. And then you took a sheet of gold and placed it where the palatal vault would be, and you hammered over the counter die with perhaps a 10-pound hammer until you swaged a gold plate. Then you trimmed the excess, which you didn't need, and there were ceramic teeth in blocks of either 1, 2, or 3. And you then soldered the ceramic tooth or ceramic block or blocks to this swaged gold plate. Now, of course, only wealthy people, even in those days, could afford that kind of denture, but it was looked on as a beautiful denture. Of course, the usual denture was made of hard rubber, vulcanite. And when you remove the vulcanite denture from the vulcanizer, you had to keep the windows open because of the hydrogen sulfide which escaped. Because sulfur made the soft rubber, which is called caoutchouc, C-A-O-U-C-H-O-U-C, caoutchouc. And I might tell you here that Thomas W. Evans, whose money built the dental school at the University of Pennsylvania, and that's a long story which would take at least half an hour. He was one of the originators of vulcanite. He noticed he had some caoutchouc on a windowsill, and flowers of sulfur had apparently dropped on the caoutchouc, and the heat of the sun had apparently made this soft rubber hard. Mr. Goodyear, of higher fame, visited his office, and they mentioned it to Goodyear. Goodyear had a brilliant idea, and 2 years later obtained a patent for hard rubber. I'm going to digress for a moment. He sold the patent to two people, and they required a fee, 50 cents for a partial denture, as I recall, and $1 for a full denture. And the dental profession was up in arms about this. And one of the members of the dental profession, and there was litigation over a period of 3 or 4 or 5 years. One of the members of the dental profession who fought this royalty was quite incensed, and he followed one of the names of one of those two men who held the patent paper, and he followed him, mind you, all the way to the West Coast. Had an argument with him and shot him dead. And if it weren't for the fact that one of the dental associations decided that I think the name of the person who shot him was Colton or a name similar to it, if it weren't Colton, C-O-L-T-O-N. If it weren't for the fact that the Dental Association got money together to defend him, he might have gone to jail for life. At any rate, such was the period in which my dental knowledge was born. And as you can tell from that, it's a far cry from what dentistry is today. I'll talk a little bit about what endodontics was very shortly, but in the meantime, I'd like to show some landing slides of that period, more or less. So may I please have the slides? Person of great charm, and he was born in Philadelphia at the site of our present dental school, actually. And in those days, you could get a medical degree in something like 1 year after you were a dentist, or a year and a half, at most 2 years. And he got his medical, no, he didn't get his medical. He decided that he was not interested in medicine. I think I better get back to the original thread of the story. May I have the next slide, please? This is an example of the engine that we were using in our clinic at the time. The next slide, please. And this is, as you can tell from the legend, this is the X-ray machine that we were using at our school from 1914 to 1924. Now, actually, we did have two standard type X-ray machines, but apparently it was in use even 1 year after I was graduated. The next slide. We used so-called ionization to a great degree at that time. And this is a device that was on the wall. And you cut down the current. The next slide. And it was also called cataphoresis. And there was a milliampere which showed you how much current you were using, etc., how much current the patient would take, actually. It was also used to drive cocaine through the dentine into the pulp. And that originally was the purpose of it. The next slide. Yes, this certainly brings back good old days. We bought Novocaine pellets. The pellet was placed in this porcelain dish. Water was added, up to a certain level, and it was heated slightly, and then it was sucked into a syringe. The next slide. Now this is the type of syringe that I used, with needles that of course had to be sterilized. We did not always sterilize the syringe itself, as I recall, because one of the methods of sterilization was to have a jar with a holder, and you simply immerse the syringe, including the needle, in the jar. The next slide. The jar, of course, contained a cold sterilizing solution. I still have this syringe. This is an all-metal syringe. And it would start leaking back here, and you removed this narrow knob, and you put in a washer, a rubber washer, so that it wouldn't backfire when you were infected. The next slide. Yes, we also used pressure anesthesia. Now, pressure anesthesia was of two kinds. One in which you expose the pulp, and that was not always painless, I can assure you. You expose the pulp, you put a small pellet of Novocaine. I would say it was only about 2 millimeters in diameter. You placed it over the exposure, and then you took a piece of caoutchouc, that is unvulcanized rubber, and then used a flat-faced instrument, and you pressed hard. I can assure you it was painful at first, but amazingly, the Novocaine was dissolved in the blood, and anesthesia was had. That was one method. The other method was to use a high-pressure syringe like this, or like the next one, or like the next. The next one, I owned at one time. It is now in the Smithsonian Museum. And as you see, there is a trigger device, and you pressed hard, and it shot the Novocaine out into the pulp. The next slide. By the way, also I should mention that when I first was graduated from school, from the dental school, I didn't have money to open an office, and I was associated with a dentist for 1 year. And he was using cocaine. And cocaine was sold to him by an itinerant salesman. It was about a 4-ounce vial with a rubber cap. And you simply use a little alcohol to sterilize the rubber cap, and then inserted your syringe and pulled out whatever you needed. And this continued until all the 4 ounces were used up. We had not been using cocaine in our school, of course, so that I suggested to him that we use propane or Novocaine. He didn't take it too kindly at first, but then we did use the Novocaine, and every now and again he would say, oh, I used to get better results with propane. Professor Otto Balkhoff is someone whom I visited in 1928. He was then retired, living in Lichtenfelde outside of Berlin, and he was the first one who took an x-ray film. Yes, it was not a film, because the film had not yet been invented. In those days, photographs were made on glass plates, which were covered with a coating, a sensitized coating. And when I visited him, he went upstairs and took down 2 tubes, one of which he took the first dental x-ray photograph. And the first digital photograph was a it kind of affects the crowns of the key felony. It's called a bike. It was a bike wing film, so to speak, for the simple reason that he took a glass plate, wrapped it in rubber dam, placed it in his mouth, and lay on the floor for 20 minutes. 20 minutes is what it took to take the photograph. Also, there was a table which rocked back and forth for developing films, which was called a titubator, T-I-T-U-B-A-T-O-R. And it took about a half an hour to develop the film in those days. So I was at Professor Rothko's home. I held the first gas tube, because of course the Coolidge tube was not yet invented. I think it was invented in 1914 or 1917. And by the way, he took this photograph 2 weeks after Rentgen announced the discovery in 1895. And he was also the person who first advocated the use of camphorated paramonocorpine. The next slide. This is a reproduction of the photograph which he took of his own mouth. The next slide. This is a photograph of an X-ray machine taken in the office of a former friend of mine, Dr. Theodore Blum, who got his BGS at the University of Pennsylvania, originally from Vienna, where he had gotten his MD degree, and a famous oral surgeon of his day. You can see that it was not a very safe machine. If a patient touched this wire, he'd be electrocuted. Next slide. And this is a another model, somewhat similar to the one that we had at school. And the next slide is a very early model put out by a medical firm, Waite and Bartlett, for dental use. And again, it was not a safe machine. Now the next machine, the next slide, is an apparatus such as I first had. And again, it was not altogether safe. For example, this tube were turned around, it was within reach of the patient. And again, if you touched this wire, you would be electrocuted or at least knocked out of the dental chair. Now, don't think that this didn't happen. I do recall, I know of only one case where a patient was electrocuted, but I've heard of other cases where a patient accidentally touched the machine and were knocked out of the chair or similar, something similar to it. The next slide. This is a type of pulp tester that I first used. That's a pulp tester that we were using at school. And naturally, it was sold by medical houses, medical supply stores. And it consists of an interrupted primary and secondary current, or a combination of the two. You could increase the current by combining both the primary and secondary. The next slide. Perhaps you know the artist, Toulouse-Lautrec, and gives you some idea of looked like in his time. He simply didn't wear a white coat. He simply tied a great big sort of apron around his neck. The next slide. Was that the last? Well, we're not quite ready for that. And we'll stop here and we'll turn on the lights. And for the rest of the morning, I plan to talk on genital focal infection. I wonder if you realize that. Oh, yes, I promised to talk first on what endodontic treatment is like. Well, first of all, the term endodontics had not yet been coined. In fact, I would say it was not coined until about 1945. Dr. Harvey Johnston of Atlanta, Georgia, was the person who coined the word endodontia. And endodontics was part of the operative department. I became interested in endodontics because I heard the head of the endodontic section of operative dentistry say one day, well, at last, after 13 visits, we're ready to fill the root canals here. The reason for the 13 visits was basically inadequate cleansing and also, we took cultures, not only one culture, but it would require that we take two successive negative cultures before filling the root canal. And I thought that here is a part of dentistry that needs simplification. And that's how I became interested in endodontics. Teeth were devitalized by means of arsenic trioxide. This was put out by various dental supply houses. It was a combination of arsenic, oil of cloves, and asbestos fiber. And as you, I'm sure, know, it doesn't take very much arsenic to destroy tissue. You simply removed a part of this, very small, just a pinhead or a little bit more of this paste. You applied it over the exposed pulp or nearly the exposed pulp because it went through the dentine. It's an example of a drug which is non-self-limiting. And there was just a thin sheet of dentine over the pulp, you didn't have to make an exposure. You simply applied the arsenic, sealed it, and within 4 or 5 days to a week, the pulp was dead. Now, I'm not telling you, of course, how painful it was in the meantime, but occasionally it was quite painful. If the arsenic was not properly sealed, it leaked out, especially where there was a class 2 cavity, and it was sometimes difficult to seal the gingival margin. And if it leaked out, then it caused destruction with extreme pain of the destruction of the periodontal ligament and gingiva, with extreme pain and loosening of the tooth, which made it much easier for the oral surgeon to remove the tooth. As a matter of fact, one of our former Philadelphia dentists who is practicing in this area, as late as, I would say less than 10 years ago, reported a case in the Triple O Journal of loss of a tooth because of leakage of arsenic. Now, he did not, at least in his paper, he did not state that it was he who had applied the arsenic, and I'm quite sure it was not. But apparently someone was still using arsenic. Teeth that tend to be crowned were occasionally devitalized purposely. because it was said that the pulp would die anyway. Well, when you consider the fact that most of the time the tooth was prepared for a crown without the use of water by means of stones, Lizzie put out so-called heapless stones. Well, perhaps they were heapless so far as the manufacturer was concerned, but not so far as the patient was concerned. And so some dentists would remove, would revitalize teeth that were going to be crowned. If we had absorbent points in my early days, I don't remember them. But I do know that I, together with almost everyone I knew, would roll roll cotton on a three-sided smooth brooch, and we would be quite adept at that. Believe me, we could roll a so-called absorbent point in no time at all. Also, at one of the meetings of the American American Association of Endodontists, which was formed in 1943, at one of the later meetings, roughly the late 40s, a dentist from Ohio demonstrated a rapid method for rolling absorbent points in which you had a very small motor with a mandrel and attached to the mandrel was a three-sided brooch, and of course you could roll your absorbent points much faster that way. The medicaments that we used were numberless. For example, for enlarging a root canal, in 1894, James R. Callahan recommended the use of 50% sulfuric acid, and that was commonly used in my day, until I showed by experiment that 50% sulfuric acid doesn't really enlarge the root canal. What it does is to combine with the calcium to form calcium sulfate, which you recognize as plaster of Paris, of course. And it's easier to cut plaster of Paris than dentine. 30% hydrochloric acid was used. 50% reverse amphoregia, which meant four parts of nitric acid, one part of hydrochloric acid, and five parts of water, recommended by Centenis, and this was without question the most rapid method of dissolving dentine. And I can assure you that it was, and I know by experiment that it was. But if any of it got through the apical foramen, you were in trouble. I also used sodium potassium alloy, which was pure metallic sodium, pure metallic potassium in equal parts. And I suppose you know what that does when it combines with water. I used to get the interest of my child patients at times by asking them, have you ever seen water on fire? No. Well, I said, I will give you a demonstration. And so there's a very narrow vial containing the sodium potassium, which we then stoppered with the cork and also wax around the cork so the moisture from the air would get at it. So I would take a brooch, run it into the sodium potassium alloy, remove a little bit, and then over the cuspidor, I'd just go like this, just like that, you know, and the sodium potassium would drop off and there would be a flame. So this is what we used in the root canal. The object was to have the sodium potassium combined not with the inorganic, But with the organic substance of dentine and water, the moisture present, and then that would form a sodium or potassium soap from the sodium hydroxide plus the organic tissue. And we also use sodium dioxide, Na2O2, which was recommended by Dr. Kirk, our former dean and editor of perhaps the best magazine, dental magazine that was ever published, The Dental Cosmos. If you ever are looking for something which you think is new, if you go back to the pages of The Dental Cosmos, you'll probably find that it isn't so new. At any rate, sodium dioxide came in the form of a granular powder. You added glycerin to it, and this way you got it up in the root canal, and again, it combined with the organic substance of the dentine. Not with any claim. Yes, occasionally, if you're using a thin brooch on which there is sodium potassium and the root canal, the brooch would be, the tip of the brooch would be incinerated from the high heat that was developed.